I think we should probably start. Fortunately, this is a 2.5 hour presentation, so it's great to have the family in one room. Thank you. I'd love to have this chance to just share some thoughts about the notion of presence. I hope you can make out my voice. Are the words clear?
Yes.
Because, okay, even if they're not, tell me they are. The issue of presence, and I realize these are themes that are on the minds of everyone in this room daily. And I just wanted to share together some, and bring together some information that certainly wasn't around when I was more active clinically. This last year, 2013, was a bit of a milestone. It was 50 years since I graduated from Queens. Over those years, one of the themes that has really intrigued me is the issue of presence. And I'd like to look at it under four, I'm trying to keep out of your way, under four themes: goals of care, left versus right brain function, the experience of presence, and then curing versus healing. When I was 1961 to 63, in my two clinical years at Queens, it didn't take me long to figure out that internal medicine was bigger than I was. And as I was expressing my concern, a classmate said, "Look, why don't you go and ask Ford Connell if you can make rounds with him on Sundays? I'm sure he'll say yes." Ford was the professor of medicine, a cardiologist. We called him Captain Bluster. He was a larger-than-life guy. He was always had a very starched lab coat, and he flew down the hall. He was a presence. Well, when I asked him if I could make rounds with him Sunday morning, he said, "Well, no teaching mount." I owed him no teaching, knowing that he couldn't resist, you see. It was one of the important experiences in my life. We'd go around with the residents, but often the residents would be busy somewhere else. In the morning I want to tell you about was one of those mornings. The residents had gone off, and Ford and I were going to see his last patients. They were in private rooms, and they overlooked Lake Ontario. We went into the first room, and as I usually did, I faded into the wallpaper, and he said, "Morning, Archibald." Archibald said, "Morning, Ford." And then Dr. Connell sat down in the chair, pulled it up beside his bed. He said, "Archibald, I don't know if you've seen the paper, but Standard Oil is down and Universal Wheat is holding steady." And I had a little notebook that I had for things I didn't know about that I need. So I took out the book and I put the stock market. I didn't have a clue, still don't, but the stock market. And they discussed stocks for a while. And then Ford glanced under the covered food dish. while he was still talking, slid his hand. The man, Archibald, was in for a peptic ulcer. He's the CEO of a company. And Ford listened to his heart, palpated his upper abdomen, and then said to him, "Things are looking stable, Archibald. I hope you have a good day today. I'll be in to see you tomorrow." He said, "Thank you, Ford. Have a good day." And with that, he left. We went into the next room, and I faded into the wallpaper, and Dr. Connell pulled a chair up, not at the head of the bed, but toward the foot of the bed. He leaned back in the chair, and he put one gigantic size 11 shoe and leg up on the bed, and then he put the other leg over, and they were crossed. And so I watched with interest, and he said, "Morning, Joe." He's Dr. Connell, good morning to you. And he said, "Joe, I don't know if you looked out on the lake this morning." She says, "There was a real blow coming in across the lake. Have you spoken to the missus today?" He said, "No, Dr. Connell, I haven't." She said, "Well, I think you should give her a call. I'll tell you what, tell her to go down and retie the boats. Because I tell you, if you lose one of those boats and they start smashing around, you're going to be in trouble." Turned out Joe lived on Wolf Island and was a fisherman. And we walked out, rounds were finished. I stood there and watched him as he disappeared down the hall, his lab coat. And I thought, I wonder if he knows what he's doing. I wonder if that's at a conscious level. Because I just watched a business executive speaking to another business executive. And then I watched a fisherman speaking to another fisherman. And I thought, I wonder if that's something that he is aware of or it's just natural. Well, we finished our 2 years every Sunday making rounds together. And he walked me out to the front door of the Kingston General. There's another seat at the front. He walked me out to the front door of the General. We stood under the chandelier. And I was an emotional wreck. And I said, "Dr. Connell, I don't know how I can ever begin to thank you. I just couldn't speak." And he was looking up at the ceiling like this and pumping our hands like this. And he said, "Well, now, you may not have learned much medicine, but I hope you learned something about how to listen to patients." And I thought, you did know. You knew all along. His presence was spectacularly important to the people he contacted. And I was struck by that and wondered what it was that about it that made the difference. A few years later, when I first visited St. Christopher's, I noticed the same thing. Whether it was the nurses or Mary Baines or Therese Vanier, the quality of listening and presence was something that I hadn't seen anywhere else. It was just strikingly important. And again, I asked myself, what is happening here? What is the foundational issue? This came back to me as a question more recently. I don't know if you all listen to TED Talks, but if you don't, you should. Jill Bolte Taylor is a neuroanatomist, and she had a stroke. She had a bleed in her left hemisphere. You can go into Jill Bolte Taylor and watch her TED Talk. But I recommend you get her book, My Stroke of Insight. Because with the left hemisphere stroke, as it evolved, and she's a good storyteller, she found that she was slipping back and forth from left hemisphere perception to right hemisphere perception. And they were very different. And that intrigued her. And so she became interested in the differential between left and right hemisphere function. The thing that blew me away was she then said, and we can choose. I'd been sort of aware that the function was different, but she said, and we can choose the balance of right and left hemisphere. When I regained consciousness, anyway, the third issue is she then looked at the significance of the choice we make and the amount of right hemisphere function we choose to have and its impact on quality of life. My mind went back to another book because my hobby through my life has been drawing. And here is a book by Betty Edwards called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. Now what she'd done was she'd gone back to the research at Caltech by R.W. Sperry on so-called split brain studies done in the 50s and 60s that examined the difference in function of the two hemispheres. And one of the illustrations from the book is here. She asked someone to do a picture, draw a portrait, and in January, that's what he was able to do. 2 months later, that's what he was able to do. So I thought, that's amazing. So I went back to my portfolio and went back over things I'd done in the past and realized that there were a group of them, and there I selected some of them. This was the one on the left is a self-portrait after having spent the day in the Van Gogh Museum. I was already depressed, but I realized with this selection of pieces that they were different from many of the others in three ways. The degree of focus I had when I was doing them, the sense of timelessness, I really was out of time. That is to say, I wasn't aware of how long this was taking. It was totally there. And a sense of unity with what it was, the subject I was doing. And those things were clearly different. Let's take a look at now what we know about left hemisphere versus right hemisphere perception. With my beloved teacher of surgical oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering, is here using predominantly his left hemisphere. Left hemisphere perception is verbal, it's analytical, it's dominant. certainly in this situation, but it's in our culture. It's the dominant thing. It's a calculating intelligence. It offers us the capacity of critical analysis. It categorizes into hierarchies and helps us form judgments. It's logical, it's linear, it's sequential. That is to say, it's time sensitive. It takes into consideration and perceives over time. There's a past and a future. It organizes thoughts in language and patterned responses. And it lays down neural loops from the brainstem up to the cortex that are complex. If you're more interested in the details, I refer you to Greg Frashone's book from Johns Hopkins Press. And just Google that and you'll get his book on the making the point that life for all of us is one way of looking at it. Is it's a series of meeting separation challenges and having to meet those challenges, consciously or unconsciously, with attachment solutions. And that's what we're doing. And that, Frashone has shown. He's the professor of psychiatry at Harvard and a neuroscientist. And he spoke at Tom's last conference. That, finding an attachment solution to a separation challenge, is what has driven evolution. Pretty big conclusion. So this holds for all life forms. It holds for monocellular organisms. It holds for us. The language centers are involved. So with left hemisphere dominance, there's a brain chatter. Gee, it's hot in here. I wonder if I would wear anything. I wonder if this guy's slowing down. I better go up faster because it really is going to be three. That brain chatter is going on for all of us. So I suggest we're all doctors here. Take your clothes off. Nobody will notice. And you'll feel better. And so there's brain chatter and story weaving. It's left hemisphere is the home of ego identity. And therefore, also our ego defense mechanisms. There's a clear boundary with left hemisphere dominance between self and other, clearly delineated. The left hemisphere sees patterns of colors and sizes and shapes, and it evokes negative response, I suspect related to ego protection. So fear and anger and jealousy, etc., are part of that. Now here's another clinician, Tom Dooley. He died at the age of 31, 33 with a malignant melanoma. He was operated on at Memorial. He was a young man who started medical, the medical aid program to Southeast Asia. Almost everything he did was loaded with right brain bias. The right brain is spatial, global orientation in space in the present moment. There's no past, no future. It's now. And now. And now. It's a sequence of nows, and that's what it's about. It creates a moment-by-moment master collage of all the sensory input, plus the thoughts and emotions and physiologic responses. A moment-by-moment awareness of the big picture for this moment and this one. It gives us then a detailed memory of that moment. But the borders are softened. The differential between self and other is a lot less distinct. It's timeless. It's abundant. It's creative. It's expansive. It's spontaneous. It's imaginative. It's relational. It perceives a unity without a hierarchy. It interprets nonverbal communication. And then it comes up with an intuitive appreciation. There's something doesn't fit here. Everybody's smiling, but they don't look comfortable, or the other way around. So it's intuitive. It assesses the congruity of the picture. It evokes joy, wonder, awe, a sense of carefree being, and abundance. Completely different. Well, we're increasingly left brain dominant. We've shifted in our perception of reality over the centuries to striking left brain dominance. Comparing left brain rationality and right brain intuition, Einstein said, the intuitive mind is a sacred gift. The rational mind is a faithful servant. We've created a society that honors the servant and has forgotten the gift. It wasn't always that way. Chief Seattle speaks for Aboriginal cultures still. When he said, man belongs to the earth and the earth does not belong to man. And his famous quote, if we sell you the land, you must remember that it is sacred. And you must teach your children that it is sacred. And that each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. Man did not weave the web of life. He's merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does it to himself. A very different picture of the reality that I'm interacting with. I'm just a strand. If you look at the remarkable photo by Edward Curtis, any of them, and you see this dignified human being placing a prayer plume in a waterfall. This isn't just a matter of he didn't go to McGill. It's a matter of him looking in a very different way at that water and that waterfall and his place in it. And if we go north, we find the same thing in the Inuit. And it's the same for Australia's Kakadu man, Big Bill Manji. The Aboriginal, you visit the Red Center in Australia, and the sense of sacredness is just different. If you look at right brain function and see somewhere in there perception of the inner life and the sacred and spirituality and our place in relationship to the cosmos and all that stuff, you'll soon realize that over the millennia, while we love to, our left hemisphere bound, set up bills like this Quebec bill idiocy, what you'd find, in fact, is that the perception, whether it's by Jesus, a Jew, or by Ramana Maharshi, a Hindu, at a depth level, is essentially the same. People with transcendent experiences of themselves and their cosmos, whatever the tradition, when they're not talking about dogma, is the same. Here's Jesus saying the kingdom of God or heaven or something is within you. And here's Ramana Maharshi saying, 2,000 years later, a Hindu, saying the universe exists within the self. A friend introduced me to Sri Aurobindo. If you read Sri Aurobindo, who was playing with a very full deck, from India, educated at Cambridge, and interested in the his existential experience. He said, you know, I could figure it all out if the cosmos had something like, and then he describes quantum theory. I almost fainted. That was long before quantum theory. But my point is that we set up boundaries that make us, that we need to realize that there's a commonality for us all under that. Well, I would suggest there are three levels at which we relate. Three degrees of presence. The first is simply occupying the same space. Some of you have heard my story about when I had the esophagectomy. And the guys who had to have been medical students I'd taught came around in the intensive care unit. Never once eye contact. I was sitting up waiting for eye contact, among other things. Never once checked the urine output, checked the signs, walked to the end of the bed and the three residents standing right there. I could have spit. Well, I couldn't add it to them. But they were right there. And he turned and said, such a shame. I guess he may have another 2 or 3 months. In a voice that loud. What struck me about that, well, 2 or 3 months struck me, but the other thing that struck me was it was if his fantasy unconscious was that there was a glass wall there and that I wouldn't. So this is the deal here. First level, simply we're on the 24 bus. We're just occupying the same space. I didn't even, not even really looking at. Second level of presence is the presence of left hemisphere critical assessment. When we're doing a diagnosis, investigating, diagnosing, drawing, like, and curing. That's the second level. But I would posit that there's a third level. And that is the one involved in what we've been calling healing. And that's what I'd like to look at a little more carefully. I guess we'll need a definition. I would define radical presence as referring to a quality of presence, a focused awareness promoting a deepened, undivided experience of the present moment, undivided, and a profound connectedness to its content. We've all had those experiences. We have them frequently. My first experience that really blew me away was in 1954, I'd taken my bicycle in Ottawa and driven down to the Ottawa train station because they had a little machine there. You could punch a motto or your name or something in a plastic disc. And so I'd gone to do that, and I walked into this room. This is a photograph from that time. And I was stopped in my tracks, because there was a guy over there, and he would be about here. And it was so stunning that I had to sit down. Now, I'm heterosexual. It wasn't particularly the guy. It was what he was doing. He was sweeping the floor. Well, why would I be so blown away? It was how he was sweeping the floor. He was totally present to sweeping the floor. He had one of those long brooms. But it was the way he did it. I had never seen anyone so present to what they were doing. We've all had those. You walk outside if you're in the country and you're suddenly encountering the vastness and silence of space. Suddenly you're at a very different place. You walk into a room and encounter a moment of intimacy. Suddenly, you may be in a very different place. Or an unexpected perfection in nature. Geez, I must have passed that flower 1,000 times to look at it. The point is, I have to be there for it. When I was 17, I wakened up one Saturday morning, and there's a window opposite the foot of my bed, and the blinds were open, and there was a beam of light coming in. And just the way it was, you could see all those little flecks dancing around, and it looked, I mean, my room doesn't look like this. I picked it because the beams of light, the beam looked exactly as predicted. Well, there was something about that moment that froze me in that second, and I just watched. You know, I never told anybody about that until years and years later when I read the account of somebody who had had exactly the same experience. The light came through the windows straight from the sun above, and so inside my little room there plunged the rays of love. In streams of light I clearly saw the dust you seldom see, out of which the nameless makes a name for one like me. All busy in the sunlight, the flecks did float and dance, and I was tumbled up with them in nameless circumstance. Architectural wonders can do the same thing. They can shift you. I walk into King's College, Cambridge Chapel, and I'm shifted into a different way of seeing. They don't know how they did the ceiling, incidentally, how they got up there. Crisis moments will do the same thing. Joanne, it's nice to see you. Joanne has the best story of this. How when you're in crisis, time slows down. I was sitting just inside that door as we left Upland's Airport, and 20 or 30 seconds, minutes later, when we were in the farmer's field, I was outside of the plane. In actual fact, it was 3 or 4 minutes, as Joanne tells. It wasn't 20 minutes. Things slow down. I'll skip past the day Kennedy was killed, but my world shattered at that moment. I said the moment I heard, why couldn't it have been me rather than him? And I really meant it, because the world needed John Kennedy. And I'd just done a history and physical in the mat, walked out of the room, and I was passing the nursing station, and the nurse said, my God, President Kennedy's been assassinated. What interests me is what I remember. It isn't these photographs that I've seen 10,000 times, or it isn't an abstract event. I remember the next step I was about to take when my world froze. It was purely moved into right brain functioning. We see it, and we're seeing it every day on our television sets from Sochi, and in extreme sports and in top level sports. People in the zone have shifted into right brain. Great interview with Ken Dryden. He said to the interviewer, gee, it's a funny thing. If I'm in an important game, no. If I'm in the important game, if everything's down on the, it's right there, it's now or never. At that moment, I noticed a funny thing. Everything slows down. And when the puck comes at me, it's in slow motion. And the interviewer said, help you stop more puck. He said, not necessarily. I was very touched. I really wanted Patrick Chan to get the goal. But I was listening to Kurt Browning, and what he said was, just before the short program, he said, watch for Patrick to fall into a trance. He has to be in the moment. If he's thinking about how hard he worked to get here, or the risks, or his family, he won't be able to do it. He has to be in the moment. I thought, isn't that cool? Now, there's Kurt Browning talking about the shift that is said to be under our control. But he's using the wrong word, incidentally, and it's worth stopping to note that it isn't. So I got the photograph of that moment. Sure enough, Patrick did exactly what he said. He said, watch for him. He's going to go into that moment. And then that's what happened. But it's not a trance, because a trance has a half-conscious state aspect to it. But it is characterized what he was doing. And it wasn't what Kurt thought, for two reasons. It's not a trance. There's a greater clarity of focus. That's the issue. And you are aware of your current surroundings. You want to see something interesting? Look at their eyes. Look up and Google the history of what happened when Karsh took that photograph of Marian Anderson. That's a photograph about as pure right hemisphere perception as it'd be possible to get. And there's Patrick Chan. Yo-Yo Ma is a master at switching into right hemisphere. And I could tell you 100 stories to back that up. It's how he does what he does. Our wiring seems to make a difference. And different things do it for us. Now, it's an interesting slide for me, because this is my Indian son from Great Slave Lake on the far side. And Jamie's the only guy I've ever met who would smell what does it. And I have no idea what he's talking about, but it's the thing that draws him into that state of the smells. He's with his friend and ours, the Baroque musician and conductor, Trevor Pinnock. And for Trevor, it's sound. And again, the story's back from when he was a little boy, where he first recognized that. And this is John Francis Williams, an artist, Montreal artist. For him, it's sight. But we use both hemispheres. I was talking to Trevor about this at one time, and he said, oh yeah, when you're going back over a manuscript and learning it again, afresh, it's all left hemisphere. Then he said, but when I'm doing it, when I'm conducting, my job is to set it free. I thought, what a wonderful comment. Music does that, and we've been blessed. Our program was the first anywhere to have a trained music therapist help us explore the depths. It's interesting to go back in the first paper we published to read the cases that we described, and we're seeing it with Deborah's help every day. So here are the two slides that we've been getting to all this time. Enhanced right brain perception, whether naturally occurring or intentionally evoked, decreases the brain chatter, that incessant brain chatter that goes, oh God, I got to remember to pick up a loaf of bread on the way home tonight. And, oh my Lord, I parked the car. It's almost out of gas. And that chatter that goes on is dampened. There's less sense of physical boundaries of space and time, and a sense of expansiveness. There's an increased sense of calm, an increased sense of silence, an increased presence, awareness, alertness, and listening. Can really listen to the situation. Increased sense of community, connection, and openness. Increased intuition. And here's the real big one. And if you and I are experiencing that, it fosters a similar response in the person we're with. There's a slowing of time, as Ken Dryden said, or a shift out of time into the now, as Peter Toll said, a sense of awe, wonder, a sense of the sacred. And this isn't religion tied. If we'd had Chris, our atheist friend who writes on Chris Hitchens, he would tell you exactly the same thing. Sense of the sacred, a sense of enhanced depth and meaning, a sense of increased alertness, a shift from ego to deep center, or self with a capital S, as Carl Jung put it. Shift from left brain serial processor thought to right brain parallel processor thought. An expansive big picture perspective. An opening to healing. And it's, as Jill Bolton Taylor said, accessible at will. So now if I go back and look at my favorite quote from Viktor Frankl when he got out of Auschwitz and Dachau, where he'd been for 3 years. And he wrote Man's Search for Meaning. He told me in 8 days after getting out. And when he said, everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose our attitude in a given set of circumstances, to choose our own way. We're free to choose. My sense now, having putting this together, is that this is a big part of how it is we are free to choose. An observation is that what we're talking about is the goal in all meditation of all kinds, whatever form it takes or the way it's dressed up. And some of you wear suits will remember taking care of Benedictine John Main when he was dying. Sue went to see him that day. Whatever the path in that this particular kind of meditation uses, it's the goal is the same thing, to move, to slow, to open, to move beyond ego, past the still point, into the quantum sea of stillness that's within us, and access that. One privilege and one moment in life I treasure was the first time I watched Jean Vanier listening, because I really couldn't remember, I guess this was in the 60s, couldn't remember ever having seen somebody listen like that. And I thought of it as embodied listening. It was as if Jean was looking right into the soul of the person. It was remarkable. I took this picture of Elizabeth and realized it's exactly the same thing. The reason Kubler-Ross could be at the American College of Surgeons meeting and have 5,000 in the audience and have them wheel in a patient she'd never met and have her find something useful and meaningful and of depth is because of how she was listening. Like the rest of us, Elizabeth had feet of clay, but boy, she sure knew how to bring in embodied listening. And I know each of you in this room, and this is Ina, who was the initial physician in our service, the initial physician, clinician, and director of clinical care, and her capacity to listen exactly like that. The product being our capacity for attachment, and Gregory Frachon, the Harvard psychiatrist, neuro-researcher, calls attachment our evolutionary neurobiologic birthright. That's how we got here, neurologically and consciously, was developing this. And Greg says, we are hardwired to make attachment solutions to our as our response to separation challenges. Such responses foster health and quality of life and are, in essence, spiritual in connecting us at an experiential level. Some of you have seen, we've had discussions about the quality of life continuum from of the people we're caring for with advanced disease, and that at the lower end there's Cecily's total pain and suffering and anguish. but up at the upper end, there's that remarkable thing, a sense, a potential for peace and integrity and wholeness. So then the question for me became, well, if a person is moving that way, what would I call it? Well, I choose to call that wounding. But if we get a response shift toward the right, I'd call that healing. And it seems to me that's what we're trying to evoke. So it raises a couple of questions. Are there common themes? Because if we could understand why a person is stuck there, maybe we could help promote a response shift like that. And then we need to have the answers. So Pat Boston and I, with Robin's help, did a study. And we recall that at the wounded end, there were common themes. And this is what was happening for the people at the wounded end. A sense of isolation, a sense of disconnection, and a crisis of meaning, an existential vacuum, an inability to find solace and peace, a preoccupation with the future and the past, dominating thought, a sense of victimization, a need to be in control. So if Donald Lowe, microbiologist who never sat at the bedside of a dying person, for God's sake, when he made this video that the CDC made so much of, if Donald Lowe had come to you guys, what would you have done? We would have sat down. Or if he'd gone to Mount Sinai in Toronto, which was his hospital, and had arguably the most effective palliative care program in Toronto, if he had availed himself of what was right there, what would they have done? They would have gone through this mental list and to ask, what is really going on? Where is the suffering coming from? What is this about? Because we know it doesn't have to be like that. Frances Hickey, when I took this picture, is a young woman. She's a librarian, and she has a complete bowel obstruction with ovarian cancer. And I took the picture of her then. She's at the other end of the scale, with a sense of connection to self, to others, to the phenomenal world around her, to ultimate meaning, whatever it meant for her, God, the cosmos, the more, the quantum, whatever. She had a sense of meaning in the context of her suffering. She could find peace in the present moment. And my God, if Viktor Frankl could find peace, reread Man's Search for Meaning. If he can find a sense of peace at Dachau, that's a lot tougher school than mine. I better be able to find a sense of peace here. A possible sympathetic connection to suffering. An openness to the potential of the moment that's greater than a need for control. We've all had patients in our mind, like the two that always come to my mind. Phil Simmons, diagnosed with ALS at the age of 35, who wrote this absolutely stunning book, Learning to Fall, The Blessings of an Imperfect Life. If you can get it through Google, though, not through stores now. Or Chip Drury, member of the Canadian National Ski Team. I thought I'd cured him with the retroperitoneal lymph node dissection, and then he died. And said to me in our last conversation, you know, Val, I love you. But there's something else. This last year has been the best year of my life. professor, he'd been head boy of LCC, he'd always a champion of everything, most popular guy in the world on the ski team for the best year, Chip, tell me. I've always been very outwardly directed. But in this past year, when he was going from looking like this to looking like a skull with tissue paper stretched over him, for those of us who loved this guy, it was just hell. Chip said, but this year, it's been a journey inward, and it's been the most exciting journey of my life. And I think of this woman, and because for me she represents the potential of what we can do. A young woman with a teenage daughter, a single parent, she'd just taken out a mortgage on a house in Montreal West. She has breast cancer, metastatic to spine, sore back, take a picture, lytic metastases throughout her genes, can't even see her spine. We admit her right away to get her on radiation therapy. If she coughs, she's going to collapse her spine. She coughs, collapses her spine, and suddenly she's paraplegic and won't ever walk again. Still, teenage daughter, single parent, new mortgage in Montreal West. And we all felt so impotent. You know, we would have done anything to be able to change any of those things. I wasn't caring for her, but she knew who I was on the team. And I came in and I sat down beside her one day. And I did all the things we do to distance. I said, now, how was your night? And are you comfortable now? And how was breakfast? Were you able to eat anything this morning? And all the safe things. I'm not saying those aren't important. But then I looked at her and she looked at me and I felt impotent and she knew I felt impotent and I knew she knew I felt impotent. I didn't know what to say, so I said to her, do you like music? And she said, well, yes, I do. And I said, well, what kind of music do you like? And there was that just glance that made me know that she was asking, do I trust this guy enough to tell him about the music I really like? I guess she thought she did. Because she said, well, Elvis. And I said, really? Do you know, in 1957, I went to his concert in Ottawa, and she said, you were at the Ottawa concert? You're kidding. And I said, no, yeah, I was there. I never told anybody that before. And she said, tell me about it. So we spent the next half hour, me telling her about the Ottawa concert. He was 22 years old. It was the first time he'd been in Canada. I remember him doing that as he came out on stage, just as if it was yesterday. I told her about the concert, and she told me about the King, and about his music, and his generosity. In Graceland, his relationship with his mother, he was still living with her. And when we had this conversation, and somebody's got to be thinking, Jesus, this guy's nuts. He's a real romantic. Here's a young woman, single parent, teenage daughter, new mortgage, paralyzed, paraplegic. You really think a half-hour discussion about Elvis Presley makes a difference? My answer is, you bet I do. And the reason it makes a difference is because it's not somebody else saying, you know, it's going to get better, you're going to adjust. It's her, Bishop Arrhenius, in the second century called that man alive, man fully alive. I may have significant pain, but no anguish, no suffering. Conversely, I may be symptom-free, but suffer terribly. There are endless modifiers of our experience. And here she was experiencing now as a paraplegic, nobody telling her something soppy. She was experiencing being as alive as she had ever been in her life. Eric Cassell says, our intactness of, as persons, our coherence and integrity come not only from intactness of the body, but from the wholeness of the web of relationships with self and others, our attachments. What we are doing when we're provoking a response shift to the right in quality of life is we're helping them, we're setting the ground, we're fostering healing connections. Our presence matters. Entry into community with something greater and more enduring than the self. That's what Greg would call attachment, and that's the core quality of life issue. And the point is, we can be catalysts. Why bother with radical presence? Because healing begets healing, and wounding begets wounding. Just ask Don Lowe's wife. And it does that for both the caregivers and the care receivers. John Seeley is one of my great teachers. Many of you may have known him here when he was head of nephrology, and then in Ottawa, head of internal medicine, and then dean of medicine. I think of him, he was always radically present. And there are three clinical quotes that I think sum up and relate to all of what we've been saying. David Kuhl, I just love it, he said, what we know cures. Who we are heals. Cicely said, the way care is given can reach the most hidden places and give space for unexpected development. And Michael Ballant, the psychiatrist and family physician in London, said, the doctor or the nurse or the music therapist or the volunteer is the medicine. It's how we're there. With radical presence, we bring listening as presence. Presence as silence. Silence not as an absence of sound, but as an inner condition of profound stillness that leaves ego behind. So if we conclude that our neural circuitry enables us to choose enhanced right hemisphere input, thus promoting greater healing of self and others, what must we conclude? Does it not suggest that we must choose that path on a daily basis? Thank you.